Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Relative Pitch. Today seems like a long time coming because I'm so excited to have this wonderful person join us. Please welcome Dr. Cliff Crooms. He is the Associate Director of Bands and the Director of the Longhorn Brand at the University of Texas at Austin. Hello, Dr. Crooms. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to be here.
Perfect. Great. We are so excited for you to be here. We have been seeing you around and all the things that you've done. And we have just been like, oh, my gosh, we got to have him on the podcast. We've seen you come into our rooms at different sessions, at different little things. So it was only right for you to come join us here today. So for anybody and everybody that is listening, can you give us a little background of how you become the famous Dr. Crooms you are today?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for that introduction. I'm from the north side of Houston, Texas. My musical journey began playing drums at my mother's church, our family church, Bella Vista, in Acres Home in North Houston. And from there, I began playing the clarinet in the school band in sixth grade. And, you know, that morphed into my percussion career there. So then I went to Eisenhower High School, also in the Aldean District. And from there, you know, I was lucky enough to be accepted into the University of Texas as an undergraduate. And I did my degree there. Along the way, I marched drum corps, drum and bugle corps at the Cavaliers Drum and Bugle Corps out of Rosemont, Illinois. I was a percussionist there. And then from there, you know, I began my teaching career teaching in North Austin, the Pflugerville area. Funny enough, I came back to when I moved back to Austin. So I taught middle school for a few years. And then I moved to San Antonio, where I taught high school at MacArthur High School. Had a wonderful experience there. And then I was lucky enough to get my first job as a head director at Georgetown High School, which is north of Austin as well. Mm. From there, I went to LSU to get my graduate degrees. And I stayed a little bit longer, and I was on the faculty there for a few years. And then the job at the University of Texas came open, and I said, well, you know, I guess I better go ahead and apply for this because it never comes open, you know. So I applied for it, and, you know, that's what the Lord had in store for me. So I went ahead and took my blessing and moved back to Austin. And here I am, living in Pflugerville again and teaching at my alma mater.
Yes. Blessings. You know, we always say here, you know, blessings that got your name on it is meant and designed for you. And that's what it just, your story kind of sounds like. There was a blessing there and it was really for you. That's amazing.
That's so interesting that I want to go back to kind of the origin, because like all of us, like how we are where we are is so convoluted in terms of like there's like this happened, we met this person at this time, etc. But you started off in the church, which is such, we talk about this all the time because we just sometimes happen to have so many first of Southern like raised people on the podcast. And something that we have found is like that pipeline from like church musician into professional, like, you know, band, orchestra, whatever, choir, is something I don't think people talk about enough. I think we know, like knowing each other and knowing people in the field, we know that is a thing, but I don't know, is that something that you've thought about yourself or thought about like how that was, it seems like your stepping stone really into this world to start?
Well, absolutely. You know, if you let my grandmother tell it, she was like, you know, we knew you were going to be a musician from day one. You know, she'd sit me on her lap at the church and, you know, I'd be good until the choir started. And then she was like, couldn't nobody do nothing with you. Just passing you on to other people. had to take you over in the back and get a whooping. You know, just
Same.
something in the music just was in my spirit, and it still is to this day. You know, I can't believe that I do what I do, you know, and I get to, you know, be around musicians and help them on their journey as well. You know, that's just something, I guess, that's just always been in me. And, you know, I've used my gift to help other people.
Absolutely. It's about that giving back. And I really, as you've gone through middle school, high school, college, you know, what is something that kind of remains consistent? You've taught all these ages. What is something that you're like, wow, this doesn't change throughout every level of teaching the next generation of students?
I think something that has been true through like all of the different levels, middle school, high school, college, is students, you know, they seek the knowledge you have, but they really are there for the relationship and for the leadership that you offer. Because as I'm sure all of you know, everything outside of the band hall is kind of buck wild right now. But if you, once you cross that doorstep into the band hall, you know what your responsibility is, you know what you're supposed to do. It's a consistency that, you know, goes throughout all of those levels.
Yeah.
I think, especially with everything out in the world being crazy for a multitude of reasons,
Oh, yeah.
that having that like safe space, but also the consistency is true. Because some people, like, I know plenty of kids that like, go into like the music and they can like throw all their anger into it. Like, if they're playing a very angry piece, or they can throw all their like sadness into something like sleep or something like that. And it's like a way for them to get all those feelings out. So when they go back out in the, in what I call the general population, they don't need to express those feelings in a negative way, or they don't need an outburst. They can just like, okay, I got my feelings out. It's great. I'm having these feelings still,
Yes.
but I was able to get them out in a productive way. I know that was true for me in going through different stuff in high school. I was like, I need to play this trumpet. I'm gonna play real, real loud because I'm real angry right now.
Yeah, music making is absolutely therapy. You know, to be able to sit in a room with other people and create art, and you know, like you said, it can take on a number of characteristics, whether it be happy, sad, introspective, or just cranking. You know, that music will get you right. And then, you know, you go through what you go through, and then you come back the next time, and you know, you get to fellowship with your fellow musicians and have that therapy.
Something kind of bridging this with conversations we've been having these past few weeks about the current state of the world and how that has started already affecting what's going on for us within education and nonprofit arts and everything. I want to take a second to really think, like, talk about what was just said about the idea of music as therapy, because I think often what happens is as these, you know, these things come out in the news and everyone gets scared and nervous and sad, there's this feeling of like you can't, you don't, shouldn't be like enjoying anything, right? Like, it's like, oh, well, there's so much awful things happening in the world, and I want to help, and I don't know how to, and I feel like I can't go watch a movie or go see a show with my friends. But actually, when I was having conversations with people this week, I was like, actually, this is like a radical answer to that, is to go celebrate with people, is to go see the shows, is to go put on the music, is to still have the concerts when all these things are going on. Because the truth is, there's a certain group of people in the world who don't want that for everyone. They don't want that celebration and enjoyment. And like, I think what we've been talking about is actually leaning into it and like taking those moments to enjoy, whether that's playing through your favorite etude if you're a student, or playing through your favorite, like doing a duet with a friend, or, you know, if you're a conductor, you happen to have really amazing musicians around you saying, hey, let's just like read some music together and see what's going on. But Is that something like, first of all, with you being an educator that you're seeing with everything going on, is that something that you have maybe yourself felt is like, oh, there's just too much going on. I don't even know how I can enjoy this or even support my students to enjoy, you know, what's going on with everything. So is that something that you've thought about during this time?
Absolutely. The first thing I'll say about that is, I was taught, like growing up, happiness is where you find it, because there's plenty to be upset about. My first year teaching, within that first month was 9/11. So, the world changed pretty quickly, I hadn't even got my career started yet. I hadn't even got my first check.
Wow.
And it was like, oh, wow. And everybody was scared, but and just a side little story. I remember some students of mine, we were supposed to have our first performance at the middle school football game that day. And obviously we canceled it. And then they just were like, why did we cancel that? That's something that happened in New York, and they just didn't have the context to understand how serious it was, And then, of course, very shortly after, parents started picking up their kids, and then they were like, oh, yes, something's wrong. So slowly we sort of eased back into activities, and it was just our job as teachers. To provide those students with that experience to get them through, and then, after 9/11, you have Afghanistan and all of those things happening on down the line, COVID, whatever, and everybody did the best they could with COVID to not let that steal our joy, and you can name whatever issue is happening during that time period, and I think as teachers and me, definitely as a teacher, I owe so much to the profession and just music in general. I'll, go out every day. I can sort my feelings out over here, but still, do my level best to try to provide the best experience for the students.
I have a right now, and I have a student who it's all about changing perspectives with our students. She'll come in my office every day and say, "Okay, Ms. Morris, I had a great day today." I'm like, "Okay, good." And then she's like, "Okay, I've had 15 good days." And I'm like, "Okay, great." And she said, "Ms. Morris, I had a bad day." And I'm like, "Okay, so how about tomorrow? Let's make it the first of now 16 good days." And she's like, "Well, today's really bad." I'm like, "Well, we have to live through it. But then tomorrow is a new something, and you have to choose the joy. And let's make those longer and longer good days." And I think that goes strictly to what you said about choosing joy, but also, especially with students, shaping how they process their feelings. Because the world knows the world is out to get you. It really seems that way for a lot, especially in the times that we're living in. But shaping our students' perspective of how they can look, find something good in every single day, and let's make them do that. And I just want to say for Dr. Crooms, speaking to your former students, they're always like, "Dr. Crooms was the best." Even your college students are always in the Longhorn band, or like, "We are having the, best of time." How do you create culture within every place you've been, and how long would you say it takes to create that culture?
I start with it. It's gonna sound not funny, but my mom's a Sunday school teacher, and I watched her for my whole grown up life greet kids coming into her classroom, with just happiness and respect, and I just modeled that. And sometimes students don't really get that in other places, and they like it's funny how your students will sort of emulate what you do. No, if you're always like, y'all better get in here and act right. Y'all better play for me today. They start interacting with each other that way. But if you greet them with like, hey, how you doing? How's the math class? And I'll ask them, at the beginning of class, what are you learning? Teach me something. So that's the respect of, sort of guiding them into being an academic colleague. Teach me something. I don't know everything, but I would love to keep learning. So as I teach them, they also teach me. So that just creates a culture of respect, mutual respect. Also, expectations. Like if I get upset about something, it's not because they didn't know what was supposed to happen. My go-to phrase is, what am I going to say? Tell me what I'm going to say. No, we know. Okay. Well, let's do it. And going back to the whole thing, it's all about happiness and joy. We're not walking around like smiling and grinning like clowns or anything like that, but just, we're holding pieces of wood, pieces of metal, giving them voice. And, it's a blessing to be doing that. So it can't be that bad. You can focus on your problems or you can focus on your blessings.
Amen. I always like to joke to people. I teach at a college. I teach how to play plumbing at a college, because that's all a trumpet is. But no, I mean, going on the whole creating culture, I've noticed this. Especially we had the Score podcast on, I think 2 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, and like what you were kind of saying is making deposits into the emotional bank, the emotional relationship between a student and teacher, and letting them know that like you're here for them. Like that's the biggest thing. Like in the brass department of UNG, I would like bust up in their doors of any brass player who's practicing. Like, what are you practicing? Okay, you just played that 7 times the same way. I don't know if you know what the definition of insanity is, but you're executing it. So let's figure out a way to work this rhythm out, because I'm not trying to hear that when I'm doing these emails, because I don't like these emails. And just like get it, be in an open resource. And my office is always open as long as I'm not teaching. So, and they all know they can stop by at any time, even if they're like, Professor Brown, I hate this teacher. Okay, let's not say hate. We do not like what's happening with this teacher. Please tell me what it is. And are you overreacting, or are we actually reacting the right way? And just like trying to help them navigate. That's the biggest thing with college, and I know you know this, is trying to teach them how to be adults, because at some point we've missed a couple of things along the way, like how to talk to people, how to make sure that people have their own timelines. I have this one student, love him, but he will come up to me and be like, I need you to do this. I love that. Okay, those are my degrees over there. You got no degrees over here. So let's fix the way we talked that. And it was a learning curve, and I love that. But culture is more important than I think a lot of educators realize.
It's the most important thing. Dr. Kelvin Jones, I stole this from him, and this is so true. Students do not care how much you know until they know how much you care. And going back to that student saying, I need this, that's when you say, okay, we need to talk about the difference between wants and needs. Because you want me to do that, and I would be more than happy to do it for you, but it's the way that you approach that. Okay?
Shout out Dr. Kelvin Jones. He's a former guest as well of the podcast, always dropping those little gems and things around. I want to, especially in today's climate, DEI has become a very blurred term and almost very unspeakable to speak out loud. And I know you have spoken on what it actually means, but can you give a little bit of a definition for somebody that is listening to help them understand what it that is and how it is not something so atrocious that our current maybe government and others are saying that kind of negatively it is right now.
Yeah, so diversity, equity, and inclusion for me just means that everybody has a chance to participate no matter what the God gave them coming into the classroom. I don't feel like it's, exclusionary to anyone else to include someone. Now, if it was a process where this is taking from someone else, that would be something I would have to examine. But I don't feel like diversity, equity, inclusion takes from anyone. It just allows others to participate in everything that we're doing. We want to see, all cultures represented. We want to see, students coming from whatever socioeconomic background, bringing their brilliant mind and getting to participate in something. So to me, the term has been co-opted like other terms before it. You know how vernacular, starts one way and then people use it as a weapon for whatever agenda they may have. But to me, I think diversity, equity, inclusion is, a great tool to help our students and our society level the playing field.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We talk about DEI so much. We are a podcast who started in 2020, with the pandemic, and there was so much talk of just everything going on, specifically around DEI, even though it had been something for a few years before that in itself. It had been coined, let's say, a few years before 2020. It really like hit the streets, one would say, during 2020 especially. And I think you immediately pointed out the biggest issue that people have with DEI is this idea that they lose something if they are not one of the groups who are specifically benefiting from DEI. Here's the truth. Everyone benefits from DEI. Everyone benefits if the person who is, let's say, at the bottom of the society totem pole is benefiting, we all are. We all get raised up. We all benefit from this. But what a lot of people unfortunately see is if this group is getting more, that means I'm getting less. And that is one framing you could have in it if you are not contextualizing and what it actually means for the full landscape. This was something we talked about with a very specific composer a few weeks ago, there was a whole social media outcry about I lost my job or I couldn't get any work because X, 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 X. And honestly, there may be other stories where people notice that they had a harder time finding jobs during specific time frames, but not everyone did. So I think the issue with that specific case, and as people try to use like I'm losing, people are losing jobs because of DEI, it's not as a trend as they're trying to make it. Like if this happens, this will happen is what they're trying to say, which is not the truth. And yeah, DEI, it's hard. It's hard to say it even out loud these days because immediately some people in the room will tense up. And it's not even just the people who don't like it, it's even people who may know what it actually means, but they're just kind of reflecting of like, oh, who else in the room is going to say something about it? Someone's going to get mad because DEI was just said. And I've just gone away with it. I usually just go accessibility and inclusion is usually what I'm coining now just to even get away from it. But I'm thankful for people like you who are, speaking up about it. It's this idea of that everyone gets to benefit. Everyone should have the opportunity to participate, not based off of just what they're bringing in, but we're going to level the playing field here, which is exactly what our belief of that is. So thank you for outlining it that way.
Absolutely. And it is a sort of a time where just speaking certain terms, you don't know like what's going to happen or who's listening or who's watching, you know, and you can still believe in the concept without saying the words. No. So I think whatever, again, going back to vernacular, what however you want to label it, I think the intent is all about just, you know, making sure that everyone has an opportunity to participate.
Absolutely. Equal the playing field, as you said.
And now, you know, as I'm about to try a segue. You know, we're talking about changing perspectives, looking at different things in a different perspective. I love to, in my class of music appreciation, I teach in a very rural part of Georgia. So a lot of my thing, we do classical music, yes, but a lot of it is exposing them to the things that I enjoy, hip hop, rap, R&B, like those genres. And so after the Super Bowl and after the Grammys, I gave 45-minute lectures on those two specific events. And Anthony shared that you had an amazing post about the Super Bowl. And I was gonna open the floor for you to discuss. How did you feel about the Super Bowl halftime show?
You know, I thought it was brilliant. Leading up to that, the AFC Championship game with, or sorry, not the AFC Championship game, the Christmas Day game
Shout out Beyonce.
when Beyoncé had that beautiful performance,
Yes.
and she had the white carriages, which symbolized the Juneteenth
Yes.
parade back. Like early in the 19th century, she really did her research. Her team gave so much symbolism, and all of the music was just incredible. Like the way she included all of the other black female country singers and Shaboozey, you know, that opened my palate up to like, let me see what they got going on. And it was all beautiful. So I felt like that was like a good primer for the Super Bowl halftime. And as much as I enjoyed it, I knew something was wrong like right away because people were like, what you think? And I'm like, what I think? It was dope. Like, and then like it started being like a bigger conversation than it really should have been. But you know, my take was this. Igor Stravinsky, who was doing, you know, sort of a doing what the masters before him had done, like the musical masters before him had done in terms of romanticism. And then he goes into his neoclassical bag and pulls out the Rite of Spring, and people lost their minds. Like, you can't be doing this on the ballet stage, not at the Paris Opera. We don't do such things. And you know, he was like, I'm not trying to create what was, I'm trying to create what is. I know what's hot in the street. And that's, you know, like it's history repeating itself. You know, what's hot in the street right now may not be like, you know, people want to relive the classics, and but that doesn't move the culture forward. You know, and the prototype of, well, let's get, you know, somebody that's been established for so many years and had this many records. Like what the Super Bowl did is they were like, this man just won a Grammy last week, five Grammys, like within a calendar week. Like, so they were able to jump on what is happening at this exact moment. And I thought it was brilliant. And, you know, Drake better watch his neck because.
Ooh. Yo, I'm like, I replayed the moment. Say Drake, and he looks at the camera. And I'm like, you gotta be like, and the I think it was like the best pacing is like everybody wanted not like us, like everybody and they mama, and he made him wait, and he made him wait. And then when it came, it was just like, okay, we over y'all. We about to party. And then he's getting off and we're going. And I was trying to explain to like my class. I was like, a lot of, because I took a poll, a lot of them enjoyed the Dr. Dre. halftime show, which was also not as controversial because like the age range that watched the Super Bowl grew up with them as artists. But I was like, y'all had no problem with Kendrick in that show. But now that he has his own show, we have some problems. And why? And so like, because we also I give a whole there's a whole week at the end of the semester. It's called What Is Good Music? And it's talking about the Pulitzer Prize. And we of course bring up Kendrick and his Pulitzer Prize. I'm like, so why don't we like this? Or do we just not favor this genre? And trying to get them to understand that you can dislike a genre or you can just not like it, but you have to see talent and see art and recognize that and appreciate that, but don't have to say, oh, I don't like it because I don't like it. Appreciate it, and it may not be your cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I talk to my students about that as well. And you said something that was so key. You know, a lot of times when we don't like something, it's because we don't understand it. You know, and if you don't seek to understand it, then, you know, that's on you. But a lot of other people understand it and, you know, find the beauty in it. And there's still some things where I'm like, okay, I understand what they're doing. You know, I may just not listen to that 100 times, but I can appreciate the work that went into it and know that there's artistic value. Like, but just to jump on it and be, no, I don't like that. It was trash.
That was the thing that I took to heart. Well, first of all, I will go on record. Anytime anybody says something about Beyonce, I'm gonna take it to heart. That's my girl. That she's right there on my wall. I got three pictures with her on my wall. So anything Beyonce, I'm gonna take it to heart. But what really put me in the mood about the halftime show at the Super Bowl was how many educators, music educators, was writing it off like it was unworthy, how it was completely not musical, things like that. And the question then comes, what about your students who sees themselves in Kendrick, who that is their kind of first impression of what music and what art is? Are you invalidating those students now? And what about the audiences that we all have to get into our concert hall? Those are the people that are listening to Kendrick. But because you have now basically said that isn't art, that isn't music, you've now limited to a certain, it's become exclusionary instead of being in an inclusive situation where, just like Michael's, teaching in music appreciation, that's what we should be teaching. Appreciate. You might not understand it, but that is my job to open your ears, open your eyes to something new. Why didn't, a lot of those educators take that aspect from it?
I think before I want to add to that as a student, there was many, many, many times in different ensembles where, our director would say, "Hey, some of you may not like it, but it's okay. The point of this is that you may find an appreciation for it in a different way. Maybe you'll never like it. That's okay, but it still deserves a certain level of respect. That's what we're gonna do." I've played many pieces that I'm like, "Oh, I just didn't enjoy it. I just even if I understand it and I respect the composer and how we our interpretation, our conductors, the way they're wanting to do it, I'm like, I appreciate it and I'll respect it, and even I may play it well. Who knows? I play Mozart well, and you will never hear me saying I love Mozart, because I don't. But I will play it in a tasteful way that Mozart should be played in, with giving it the right respect, but not needing to go online and bash and say I hate Mozart, he's the worst, and all this stuff. And so it's just a weird like juxtaposition of what sometimes music educators are trying to get their students to do and what they say is like should be done from a respectful student standpoint. And then when you see their commentary on the Super Bowl, on these halftime shows, and it's a complete opposite of what they're preaching to their students. It's just so it's weird to see when those things happen.
Yeah, and to that I will say, you know, like this is also part of my post, like really great art provokes questions and elicits a response. You know, and I would say to those music educators, you know, like it affected them in such a way to where they felt like they had to, share with the world their distaste, and that's totally within their right. But I think it sort of exposes a need for more investigation, a need for more research. Not that, I think like music educators are doing the Lord's work, but we can all be better. Like I think about some of the stuff that, I'm like, what's going on with that? Like, I'm not really feeling that, but then I'll like ask, so what about this? Like, why do you enjoy this? And again, going back to the students teaching me. Like I remember when I was teaching high school and I had a music and media class, and the Charli XCX was hot at that point, and I was like, tell me about Charli. Like, what's going on? And they were like, oh, this and that. And then there's this message and all these different things happening. And then you see, her music sort of has longevity up until this point. And I'm like, okay. So that for that group of people that enjoy that music, it reaches them in a certain way. And I've listened to some of the stuff, with a broader mindset, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I mess with Charlie.
I actually just had a moment actually with a friend to the show, Dr. Jack Eady, a couple months ago. I posted something on my Instagram, and it was of Doechii, who I love. Doechii, she just won the Grammy for Best Rap Album, and I don't think Jack knew Doechii yet, and he was like, "Who is this?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, you got to listen. It's this and that." And he took the time to listen, and then he texted me, was like, "Oh, this is fine. Like, this is it. That she's the real thing." And I'm like, "Yeah, have these conversations with your friends. Open them to music." I'm always asking my students, "What are you listening to?" Right now, I'm teaching in Houston, and right now they're listening to, first of all, a person that I did not know, maybe showing my age, was Chappell Roan. Did not know who that was when I first made it, when I first started teaching back in middle school. I was like, okay, let me go listen to who Chappell Roan is. She's big, she is popping, she is everywhere. So
Absolutely.
it's about, seeking that discomfort of listening to something new or going to do something you didn't think that you would like. You might end up liking it. Pink Pony Club. Is that what you're saying, Michael,
No,
over
he's doing
there?
hot to go.
Oh, yes.
That's how we, that is our literal first media timeout of every single women's and men's basketball game because it gets the crowd. They get to do a little thing. We either do that or YMCA. Because I'm gonna need the
Oh,
crowd.
nice.
Because I just like, I have those songs and I place them in the beginning to get the crowd invested. And then at the end of the first half, so they come back, after intermission. Oh, wait, there's called halftime there.
Yeah, and that track, is one where people like they know what to do. Like I get to be a part of the music making rather than just observing. So that's brilliant in the construction of that too.
Yeah. And so you, I will say, I think it was last year, you have some of the people that the Longhorn Band. I'm like, first of all, y'all got a lot of money because you had Andre 3000 come to your school. Okay, let me, Andre 3000 of the Outcast, come to the University of Texas Austin, talk to your students, do a whole thing. OMG, how is that? Like, I grew up with Outkast, and I'm assuming you also grew up listening to Outkast too. What was that moment of having him like walk in and you're like talking to him and he's talking to your class?
It's exactly like you said. Like he had come because he was going to play a concert at our basketball arena, and I was like, "So is it flutes or bars?" He's like, "Okay, it's flutes." So then it was a opportunity. Our flute professor, Dr. Ebony Thomas, who is amazing, she was able to reach out to his management team and said, "Hey, would you mind talking to our flute studio?" And he was happy to do it. I just remember being in high school, when they were still very much underground and people just walking around the halls between classes. Me and you, your mama and your cousin too,
Yes.
rolling down the strip on Vogue, coming up slamming Cadillac dope. Like, I know that line to my heart. And
Yes.
I was just like, what is that? What's It's like, man, that's Outkast. So I've been riding him with him ever since. I talked to him about, when they did a concert at our student union when I was in undergrad, and not a lot of people knew who they were back then. They could do a concert in the student union, and it wasn't even real full.
Right.
But no, getting to meet him and talk to him, and he's now an adult and he's got grown kids and all of that. Just getting to talk about his journey, and he's just on all of that right now. It was really amazing. And
Yeah.
side story of Outkast, when they did the side by side album, Speaker Box Love Below, this is where I learned, you need to investigate, because I was used to like the Dirty South style of rap. And then Andre 3000 comes in with this symphonic sound, all of this stuff. And I was like, man, what happened? Dude got soft. And then the next day, I listened to it again and I was like, this is a masterpiece. It was just one day ahead of its time.
Agreed.
And so much of like that changed the arc of hip hop. People weren't afraid to, do more symphonic, do more things with strings. And then down the line, you start seeing Kanye and Jay-Z do stuff with rock musicians. And like this whole fusion era sort of began after that. So, yeah, it was a masterpiece and a milestone in the culture.
And just to bring it back to Kendrick, Kendrick then takes on that same kind of thing and like that his untitled EP that he had, which then influenced Ketaj Copeley to write Dope. And like I do that whole little thing of like listen to what's going on, this music that's in us that it comes out as natural. That is so important that we put this in front of our students to say that music is music at the end of the day. Art is art. It is beautiful. It should be appreciated. This is what we should be teaching for our students. And when I saw Andre 3000 in at UT, like a classical institution, where for so long classical institutions have always said popular music is othered. It's over there. There should never be a cross population of anything. So seeing 3000 there talking to the flute studio, then talking to, everybody else, I was like, wow, this is like wonderful. Even I was like, I kind of want to be a fly on the wall. Like, I want to be there. Because for so long, we, especially people that grew up with R&B and hip hop, have always said that music does not belong on in our spaces, in our concert halls. It's put that out the door. Let it stay there. So I was just so happy to see that y'all created that opportunity for the students at UT. That was beautiful.
Absolutely. And thank you. It was, selfishly for me, I was like, man, I want to meet Three Stacks. But, for them, it was important for them to see, like, this is a institution of higher learning, and the word university really means all. So that should be in these spaces. And you got composers like Marie Douglas, coming out with like things that bridge those two worlds,
Yes.
so it's a great time for the music that's coming out right now, because there's something for everybody. Like Viet Quong, like, wow, his musical language is incredible. Also from the Atlanta area.
Shout out Atlanta. ATL
So
got it.
there's a lot happening. And a lot to be excited about.
Yes.
I also love how Kendrick is not only probably one of the best rappers ever, he is officially one of the best haters ever. And he is raising that level again. He is with one song, he has ended this man. This is something my student said in music appreciation. They said, "I don't understand why Drake hasn't thrown his phone in the ocean and just moved to a private island yet." I said, "You know, that might be next. Because if there is ever to be a Not Like Us part two, yeah, it's actually over."
Yeah, Drake might have to do something else. Like, I mean,
Woo!
because it took on a life of its own already,
Yeah.
you know, and then the Super Bowl happened, and then you see all of these people that are just now getting exposed to Kendrick through that one song, who Drake had this incredible, you know, mega career, and like, whoo, when everybody hit A minor, I'm like, this man is
That's how
dead.
you know.
It shut off.
Yeah.
So when are we gonna see the collaboration between the Texas Longhorn Band and Kendrick Lamar? You know, because you love I y'all are always collaborating. I think y'all were with Nelly, what, a couple like last year, 2 years ago or something.
Yeah, that was last season, you know,
Yeah.
to do that, and he was great.
Just y'all are just collaborating with all these people. So, you know, let's just get Kendrick people on the line and y'all can collaborate together.
I would be here for that.
You heard
I'm
it here first. You heard it here
gonna
first.
get me a ticket to that game.
Yeah.
Right. Look, I'm gonna be like, okay, Dr. Crooms, I need a little ticket. We said this on the podcast first, so we get first dibs. We need
Yeah.
first
Oh
dibs.
yeah. Oh, if we get it going, you in there. You in
Perfect. Hey, I'll wear a uniform if I got to. Put a little trumpet in my hand.
Yes.
I'll be
Oh,
marching, marching.
yeah.
And
So.
you know, going back to the Christmas Day thing, talking to Javon over at Texas Southern, I
Yeah.
told him what just how it did my heart proud to see them, the Ocean of Soul, the
Yeah.
band that my mom was in and my aunts were in, to see them wearing cowboy hats, you know, sort of tying that back to our look. You know, and he was like, man, like the designers for the whole show said it had to have this cowboy flavor, you know, and it was just nice to sort of see the two, like our uniform and their uniform for that event, sort of juxtaposed.
Yes, shout out to Texas Southern. Like that was,
They played.
it was beautiful to see. And to Beyonce and her team of showing Black culture, yet from the carriages, but to how big, you know, band culture is to the Black community, especially in the South. That was something to show, and I thought it was shown so beautifully. So shout out to all those people. That was great. And now that I live in Houston, I feel like this is my home. So I get to really be excited and happy now. Like, shout out Houston too.
Oh yeah, you're a Houstonian now.
Yes, I am. I claim it. I claim it now. You know, but
Yes.
for all the Atlanta people, I'm still Atlanta. You know, I'm still Georgian. But Dr. Crooms, you are a part of some really wonderful organizations from And We Were Heard to the Minority Band Directors Association. How have being a part of those really have been for you, and what do you see for the future of those organizations and any organization of that?
Yeah, And We Were Heard, you know, it's just, I think, a great vehicle to get music that otherwise may not have been exposed, like on the mass, to get those composers out there. Kevin Day, I remember, was very early on in that. Matt Campbell, Kalijah Dutton, like a lot of composers that are really starting to find their way, you know, got exposure through that, and I'm happy to be a part of that. You know, I've played those pieces, and you know, got a chance to expose my students to their harmonic language that is, you know, not very different, but different than, you know, what you may hear from a major label, publishing label, and the Minority Band Directors Association is just a way for people to fellowship that are, sort of going through the same things, come from the same background. Not that, if you're not a minority, you couldn't be a part of it. It's definitely not exclusionary in that way, but it's a way for, I know for me, I was the first black teacher for a lot of my students. And it's funny the way, like, when you look out at a classroom, you're looking with two eyes, but there's like, 30 to 60 pairs of eyes looking back at you. And they all may be of, the same culture, and you're of a different culture. So what they see is what is representative of our culture. A lot of times, and that's why I do the posts that I do during Black History Month, because a lot of growing up, what a lot of people saw was like, thugs and, criminals as black people, but it's like, yes, they're out there, but there's no counter to that being shown, like all of the greatness of the culture. So I think Minority Band Directors is a way for people to come together around the culture, in the same way, like those posts for Black History Month. It's for people like I have people that are like, oh my God, I didn't know Alexandre Dumas was a black man. Like, yeah, he was. And also one of the greatest literary minds in history.
And I think you're also educating other black people too. I mean, it's not just for, certain sects of people, but it's for everybody, because even growing up in a culture, you might not have been taught that certain people that is exceeding in the own in your own culture, you would know about them. So I think it's wonderful. I love seeing your daily posts of like, ooh, look at that. That's somebody new. That's, something. So that is great. And I want to just before we go about you being the first Black director. I mean, when you took the job at UT as the director of Longhorn, you were the first Black band director there for being the Longhorn band director. And if you put your name in Google, those like articles is like the first thing. How does that feel? Did you feel pressure going into that? And how do you see yourself as holding that title for where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt and do feel pressure within that job, because I am the first black man to be in that position, but also I'm the second alumnus, like second person to have been in the band to direct the band. So, I feel like there's people that were uncomfortable with maybe the decision to go with a black person, but we're comfortable with like, oh, well, he knows UT. Okay, we're gonna be all right. Quote Kendrick Lamar.
All right.
So, but yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, in your mind, you think, well, better not mess this up, because they ain't gonna give it to nobody else if that happens. And we all like, I was telling Weston Lewis this. Sometimes where other people may walk into a job, with an assignment, those of us that come in as the first, whether it be the first woman, the first black person, or whatever, you walk in, with a responsibility. Like you're carrying so many people that moved things forward. For that to even be a possibility, you want to honor their legacy, but you also want to make sure that the product is so fire that people are like, man, he good with me. He good with me. So, we just work hard every day and, make sure, like I have older black teachers come tell me like, man, you out there doing it. Like couldn't have never even imagined something like that. That's great. And, I just feel nothing but pride when they say stuff like that, or, this one like got my heart. A gentleman brought his son up to me after one of the games. And he was like, this is the first black band director, at UT. And, you could do that one day. And I just like, man, I just,
Yeah, that's
you
beautiful.
gotta let the Lord use you. And, you never can tell who's watching? But somebody's watching, and you're an example for somebody. So I'm just happy to be that.
That's beautiful. That just set me all the way right. Dr. Crooms, this has been amazing. We want to thank you so much for telling your story and speaking the truth for every one of us and guiding everyone that you come into contact with down the correct path. So thank you here from Relative Pitch of your time. And I know our audience, you're going to enjoy this episode. To our audience, I hope you enjoyed. I know you enjoyed. Dr. Crooms, how can they follow you and become part of your village as well and continue to uplift you as you continue your journey?
Sure. Well, I am on Facebook. I was on other platforms as well, but it kind of got a little noisy, so I just pared it down. But I am on Facebook, or if you want to converse through email, my email is on the University of Texas Band's website, and I'd be more than happy to meet and talk with anybody that would be interested.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. And for our audience, thank you again for listening. And we hope you have a great rest of your week. Bye.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of
I
course.
appreciate it.